celebrating 40 years of music and ideas. 91.3 KBCS Bellevue, Seattle, a listener-supported public service of Bellevue College. You're about to listen to a segment from our program, Music and Ideas, hosted by Sonia Green.
Recent events in the news point to the double-edged sword of being Black in America, from the Voting Rights Act to the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the shooting of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. The conversation about race is being hotly debated. Today, Bellevue College professor and author of Six in the Morning, West Coast Hip-Hop Music, 1987 to 1992, and the Transformation of Mainstream Culture, Dr. Dowdy Abe joins me in the studio alongside national organizer for Radical Women and part of the Free Marissa Now campaign, Ann Slater. Dr. Abe, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Ann, thanks for coming in today.
I'm so glad to be here.
So I'm just going to jump right in. Obviously, you know, if you've been watching the news, you've been hearing a lot about these cases, especially obviously the case of George Zimmerman, or shall I say the case of Trayvon Martin. But let's go ahead and start there. Zimmerman was acquitted last month of shooting Trayvon Martin. Dr. Abe, can I just call you Dowdy? I can call you Dowdy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Dowdy, what did you think when you heard the verdict? Where were you, and what was your first reaction?
I was sitting watching a AAU baseball game. Some of the parents, it was kind of interesting because this particular team is made up of primarily of African Americans. And if you know about baseball, you know there's not too many African American kids playing baseball these days. And that the reasons behind that are probably a whole other show. But so they are one of the only Black teams in all of these tournaments that they go around to play because, like I said, for that reason, not that many Black kids playing. And so I'm sitting in the stands watching, and, you know, obviously there's other Black parents in the stands, and this was a Saturday. This was Saturday, right?
Mm-hmm.
Probably about...
It was about 6 o'clock.
Yeah, okay, early evening. And everybody was kind of talking about, oh, no. At first, it was that a verdict had come in.
Right.
And so then there was that kind of space in between about when they gather everybody to the courtroom. I kind of remember the same thing around the whole OJ thing. It was like, oh, there's a verdict. And then it took time for people to actually gather in the court to hear the verdict. And so I hear it. And so I hear that there's a verdict. And then people are kind of asking. And I didn't want to be negative Nelly and be like, through the whole trial, I didn't want to be like, I don't think he's going to be. I think they're going to find him not guilty. But I was kind of having that just because if you've paid attention to the legal system around these kinds of issues in the last couple of decades, you wouldn't have been surprised if he was that he was found not guilty. And I'm thinking about incidents like the Latasha Harlins thing in Los Angeles back in the early 90s, where she was involved in a little dust up with a Korean shopkeeper. And as she was leaving, the thing was over, the shopkeeper shoots her in the back of the head and gets community service, I think. And then thinking of Bernard Goetz in New York in the 1980s when he shot up, I think, four kids of color on the subway because he said he felt like they were going to attack him. Now, they hadn't done anything, you know what I'm saying? He just had this feeling, and he got, I think, the worst charge he was brought up on, I think, was gun possession. And so, and yeah, I'm saying there's a whole bunch of other ones that I could go on and list. But I'm just saying that if you've seen that, then it wasn't necessarily a surprise. That doesn't mean it didn't hurt. And that doesn't mean that it didn't, you know, as the father of a 19-year-old African-American boy who was around that age when this whole thing first happened, you know, that's something that I hear that and I look at him and I start to think, man, that could have just as easily been my son, that kind of thing. So it definitely, even though it wasn't necessarily a surprise, it certainly hurt and it brought about, I think, at least a level of introspection amongst people who are concerned with these kinds of things around how we got here, why we got here, and how we can go about maybe trying to make sure that we don't travel down this road again.
And what about you? What was your first reaction when you heard the verdict?
Well, I thought it was a terrible verdict. I also wasn't completely surprised. I thought looking at the history of racism in the criminal justice system and the you know, putting Trayvon on trial for what was he doing, why was he walking, how was he looking. I mean, it's the same old stereotyping of black youth as somehow being criminal because they exist. So, but it was a terrible injustice.
Well, Daddy, I'm going to come to you because your book, you know, really talks about hip hop and the mainstream and the culture around it. And a lot of the conversation was about what he was wearing and this whole idea around him wearing a hoodie and what that might have signaled. Can you speak to a little bit of that culture and even just, I guess, I have opinions of it on my own, you know, obviously. But, you know, I really want to delve into this idea of this culture around hip hop and what that means. And it's just as many kids of not of color right. wearing hoodies
right.
as there are kids of color.
Right.
So why is that, I guess, an indicator, if you will?
Right. Well, you know, in this book, it focuses on that period of 87 to 92, what was happening as far as hip hop on the West Coast. And this imagery of the young black male as the quote unquote gangster, a lot of that kind of begins during the time that's covered in this book. And there was this real kind of, I don't want to say redefinition, but an alternative kind of message around what black masculinity is, what it is to be a black male, that was kind of being batted back and forth during this time. And a big part of that kind of is rooted in what's kind of known as oppositional culture, and the idea that if you have a disenfranchised population that is segregated and is suffering under oppression, there are going to be elements of that group's culture that kind of push back against what the mainstream is talking about. So if the mainstream values things like education and going to work every day and having a monogamous relationship and things like that, then oppositional culture is going to go the, you know what I'm saying, the exact opposite way. It's going to say, never mind school. It's going to say, you know, I'm going to have a bunch of kids by a bunch of different women. It's going to say, you know, I'm not going to go to work. I'm going to do something else. And that, you know, that kind of line of thinking was, again, something that was kind of being pushed back and forth around, and especially as the music really started to kind of come out into the mainstream. And this is a whole thing around what black manhood was. And it really, in a sense of popular discourse, kind of is it doesn't come to a head, but it's really highlighted by the NWA album Niggas for Life in 1991. And on that album, there were so many different songs about real ends do this, and, you know, ends for life, and all these kinds of things that in a sense kind of were making this argument about what in the sense of saying what a real N-word is, you know, it was also kind of by extension saying what a real black man is and what authentic blackness is at that point. And, you know, that kind of foundation is the thing that, at least, and also we're talking about the expansion of cable television and shows like Yo MTV Rap, so where it's now not only about the content of the song, but also now a visual presentation. You know what I'm saying? What do these quote unquote gangster rappers that are talking about this lifestyle in Southern California, you know, not only what they're talking about, but now what they're looking like.
Right. But, you know, it's such a fair assessment to say, though, you know, Mark Zuckerberg can go to Wall Street and ring the bell in a hoodie and no one says a word about it. But Trayvon Martin, a young African-American walking home with a bag of Skittles and a cup of an Arizona iced tea, whatever it was, is immediately classified, you know.
But that's the extension. That's the extension of that image that I was talking about. And it doesn't always necessarily extend to non-black people who are participating in that type of behavior. It's just kind of stigmatized. You know what I'm saying? That stigma of young black males in hooded sweatshirts is connected to what I was talking about as far as the period of the book, with like gang members probably, you know what I'm saying, holding some kind of weapon, probably involved in some kind of shady drug related activity, that kind of thing. I mean, the ability to, or the willingness of some people to make the connection of that image to all of those possibly negative stereotypes is something that is was born during that time and has kind of only grown as kind of hip hop and the exposure around it and the participation of many people of different ethnicities has grown.
Okay. Well, we're going to move on past that particular part of it to talk about another part of the case, which was the Stand Your Ground. So Stand Your Ground essentially is basically you have the right to use force if you feel your life is being threatened. You don't have to retreat. That was a part of initially what was said that George Zimmerman was using. And then, of course, when they went to court, it's alleged that they had said, no, it's just self-defense. Though, if you were listening to the juror who came out and did an interview after it's all said and done, she very clearly said that they were still taking Stand Your Ground into account. So whatever the case is, Stand Your Ground has now, the profile of this law has kind of been put to the forefront. There are several states that have the law, and the Stand Your Ground law is also the reason that Marissa Alexander is in jail. And Marissa Alexander is a 31-year-old female. She's a software employee. She has twins, had a baby 9 days prior to this incident that put her in jail. She was put in jail for 20 years because she shot a gun in the air as a warning shot to her abusive husband, someone who she had a restraining order against. And she was sentenced to 20 years for 3 counts of aggravated assault. So talk a little. So, Ian, I have to come to you because I know this is a case you know a lot about, and this is a case that you're a part of a campaign, Free Marissa. Talk about this. I mean, you know, we're talking about the stigma of being a young black male, but really, you know, race in general. I mean, because this is a black female. She's maybe not super young, but nonetheless, she's a black female, and she's suffering basically at the hands of this Stand Your Ground because she was not allowed to do what this law says you can do.
Well, yeah, and I think she was denied because she's black and female. I mean, the judge has a lot of discretion in Stand Your Ground, and he decreed that she must not have seriously been afraid for her life because had she been, he thought she should have tried to get out of the house some other way, out the window, or I don't know, he doesn't really say what other way, but that because she picked up the gun that she had licensed and used it as a warning shot, that that she wasn't justified, and that plays into the both the stereotypes of domestic violence of women and of black women. We're supposed to be subservient. It's more valuable to stand by your man than to stand up for yourself. And you know, for black women in particular, there's a stereotype of them as aggressive, as out of control. So in this case, by standing up and saying, I will not be beaten again, she is now seen as the criminal and not defending herself. So, and I mean, she is not alone. There are a lot of women who fought back against their abusers who are in prison. Marissa particularly is, I think, highlighted because of the Stand Your Ground and such a double standard where you can track down a young black man and kill him and have no repercussions. And if you're a black woman saying, I won't be beaten again, you end up in jail.
I like the way you talk about that, about tracking him down, because it was really like Zimmerman was on a hunt. You know, he's driving slow in the car. Oh, I see him. He looks like let me call somebody. Okay. No, stay in your car. No, I'm going to go ahead anyway. You know what I'm saying? And the whole thing, I think most people looking at the facts of the cases and just the basic outline would imagine that the sentences should be flipped. You know what I'm saying? I think most people would kind of point to Zimmerman and say he should have been the one that got 20 years. And, you know, the mother who has been abused and protecting herself and her children, how does it get more justified than that?
And her estranged husband in that instance had said things like, I'm going to kill you, you're a whore, you're a bitch. 5 months earlier, he'd put her in the hospital while she was pregnant.
She just had a baby 9 days.
9 days before the incident happened. So, you know, he has a record of abuse. But I think it also gets at the whole criminalization system. Part of why she was sentenced to 20 years is because of Florida's mandatory minimums. So if you do this, you are mandated to get these sorts of minimums. Mm. And what we've seen with that is a whole racial injustice. We've seen the population in prison skyrocket. I was just reading something where in 1981, there were 200,000 people incarcerated. Now there's 2.3 million. So And we have a whole privatization of the prison system. So there's money being made off of putting people, especially poor people, people of color, black women, black men, in jail.
For sure. Mostly around drug charges. Mostly around, a lot anyway, around nonviolent drug charges. But again, that's probably a whole other show.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, we probably could continue on, yeah, on down that path. But, you know, as I'm listening to you guys and I'm just kind of taking everything in and thinking of some of the other aspects of this case that have come up. But the race thing is just kind of undeniable. It's really hard to get away from that particular part of it. And I even remember looking at the closing statements and the prosecution actually saying that it did not play a role, that race, that this is not about race.
In the Trayvon case?
In the Trayvon, in the George Zimmerman, I like to call it the George Zimmerman because it really annoys me actually to say the Trayvon Martin case.
Right.
But it is true though. That's the sad part, is Trayvon Martin was put on trial more than George Zimmerman was. But in the case, they even tried to say at the end to the jurors that this was not a part of it. And I just thought, what an injustice.
Well, you know, the prosecutors didn't really want to bring that case against Zimmerman. You know what I'm saying? You saw how long it took for charges to be filed and for the case to actually come about. So the prosecutors was running from that case from the very beginning, because I got the feeling they had the feeling they didn't really stand a very strong chance against the whole stand your ground law, at least in this particular case.
Though they threw it out, supposedly, and said it was just self-defense.
It's the
same state attorney who Angela Corey, who brought the charges against Marissa Alexander.
Well, I was going to say, was the judge, was this a jury trial in Marissa's case?
In the end, it was a jury trial. The judge ruled on stand your ground, and then in the end, it was a jury trial. And I think that a lot of the facts about her domestic abuse didn't come up in the trial. So her case is on appeal right now, and there are activists in Florida, some of who are leading the Free Marissa Now national campaign, like the New Jim Crow and the Southern Freedom Movement, who just organized a march from Jacksonville to Stanford. And
there's also the Dream Defenders as well.
Yes.
What kind of legal team does she have? Yeah, bring that up. Isn't that relevant to the case?
Well, and this is a new legal team than it was. But yes, one would think it was relevant.
Well, I know that there are also some local things happening around the Free Marissa campaign. You want to talk about any of the things? I know there's some things that have already happened, but there's some things coming up as well, correct?
There are, absolutely. There's a Pacific Northwest Alliance to Free Marissa Alexander. And, I mean, when Radical Woman heard about this case, we got on the phone last year and started calling people, and folks came together and have been organizing since then. So we've done banner drops. We've done a Mother's Day parade that was linking the fight against domestic violence and to Free Marissa Alexander to the fight for social services and the kinds of things that women need to survive, that working women need, like childcare. So some of the things coming up is our next Pacific Northwest Alliance meeting is on Wednesday, April 14th at Lem's Bookstore, which is down in Columbia City. And we're also organizing a contingent to be part of the August 17th anniversary of the March on Washington. The other thing we're doing is getting people to send note cards to Marissa. We want to both let her know that she's not alone and show the prison officials that people are watching. And she said that one day, I think it was 2 weeks ago, she got over 100 cards in one day, because this campaign has blossomed to be national. But people can participate that way, and also by getting endorsers. And I think the thing is really just get involved in the campaign. As Sumaya Coleman, who's with the African American Black Women's Cultural Alliance and one of the leaders of the campaign, says, is the world is watching this. What we want is a lot of people working on it.
Well, we have links to Radical Women, as well as we have a link to Dr. Abe's book. And I'm going to say it again, 6 in the Morning, West Coast Hip Hop Music, 1987 to 1992, and the Transformation of Mainstream Culture. So we have links to both of the websites and the events that are happening. This is certainly going to be a continued discussion. I think that as we continue to watch what's going to happen with Marissa Alexander, and then I know Trayvon Martin's parents, they've kind of already stopped a change.org petition to have a real examination of the Stand Your Ground law. So I'm sure we'll continue to have this discussion. And I appreciate you, Dr. Dowdy Abe, as well as Ann Slater, coming on to have this discussion with me. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.